Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The crowd singing "We Shall Overcome" on August 7th, 1964, inside a church in Meridian, Mississippi, at the funeral of James Chaney, the civil rights worker who was killed along with Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner during Mississippi's so-called Freedom Summer. Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner had disappeared 6 weeks earlier, 50 years ago yesterday, June 22, 1964. It was an event that galvanized the nation's attention to the efforts of volunteers in Mississippi, many young white Northerners, and to the plight of black residents of the South. As we mark the 50th anniversary of their death and the work done by all the volunteers who traveled to Mississippi that summer, we are joined by Tufts historian Peniel Joseph, author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Hi, Peniel. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
And listeners, did you take part in the Freedom Summer? Call in with your oral histories, 212-433-WNYC. Why did you go, especially if you were a Northerner? Was your safety in danger at moments in particular that you recall? What else do you remember? When you look back, what are the first things that come to your mind even today? Your Freedom Summer oral histories, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Peniel, for people who don't know the history, the effort was technically a voter registration drive, correct?
Well, yeah, it was a voter registration drive, but technically, since there was no Voting Rights Act and that wouldn't be passed till the next year, what it was something to galvanize voter interest and provide voter education. So by the end of that summer, there's going to be over 55,000 people who fill out freedom registration ballots to prove to the federal government and the state of Mississippi that there are tens of thousands of people in Mississippi, black people, who want to vote but have been denied the right to vote.
Here is a clip, and we have some historical audio footage to play throughout this segment, of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee leader Bob Moses, a main organizer of Freedom Summer, talking about the efforts.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 teachers, ministers, lawyers, and students from all around the country who will engage in a program designed to open up Mississippi to the country.
And he refers to ministers, lawyers, students. Who are these volunteers?
Well, there's going to be really over 800-900 volunteers who come from all over the United States. Predominantly, they're going to be student volunteers. And these are undergraduate students at places like City University of New York and New York City, everywhere from Columbia, NYU, Swarthmore, Tufts, Berkeley, who come down. And really, when we think about what was going on in the early 60s, white activists like Tom Hayden and Casey Hayden, they thought of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, as the cutting edge of a human rights movement that was happening globally. So many students by early 63, 64 wanted to participate in the movement. Now, black activists like Bob Moses and Stokely Carmichael, some were concerned that if you brought a bunch of white students in, what would it mean for the local indigenous population? Moses argued it was going to get more attention, much needed attention, for the work that SNCC was doing since 1961 in Macomb, Mississippi, to try to register African Americans to vote.
And here's more historical audio, courtesy of NBC News. Reverend Bruce Hansen of the National Council of Churches, from 1964, talking to NBC about what the volunteers were told before they headed down.
We just try in every conceivable way to make people realize that they'd be jeopardizing themselves and the project unless they're thoroughly convinced that they want to go and work in the state, even in the face of such events as these.
And I read, Peniel, that many volunteers were turned down. So there was a concerted effort to make sure that the people going into Mississippi were well trained and knew what they were getting themselves into, correct?
Absolutely. They wanted to weed out anybody who was just into adventure, anybody who was just really a gadfly. They did weeks of training at the Western College for Women in Ohio. And that's where most of the volunteers actually heard that Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were missing on June 22nd, even though they go missing the evening of June 21st. So they really got a predominantly focused group of white student activists. But the interesting thing, Brian, is that those hundreds of students would really transform the movement. And in a sense, they were really transformed themselves. Many wrote memoirs about their time in Mississippi and how they felt. Many wrote letters back to their parents, and they were really shocked at the racism, the poverty in Mississippi. So it was an incredible educational tool for them, but they spread the word nationally as well.
You mentioned training. What kind of training would they receive for this kind of effort?
Well, the training was primarily on a few different things. One was a training in terms of nonviolence and the fact that if they were harassed or if they were at demonstrations or picket lines, how to protect themselves if they were going to be physically abused. But they were also trained in the mores of the South, meaning that, boys and girls were trained to these young men and women that they shouldn't be in interracial groups together, in the sense of if there were any kind of romantic attachments that could not be done in the light of day because of how dangerous that would be. They were trained in the sense of how to speak to indigenous black locals, many of whom would not want to make eye contact with white students, many of whom would say yes to whatever any white person said because they feared any kind of reprisals. So they were trained in terms of the lay of the land on what could and could not be done by the student workers.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio as we remember the Freedom Summer 50 years ago, part of the series that Tufts University historian Peniel Joseph is doing with us that really began last year and will run into next year, about the 50th anniversaries of some of the landmark moments in the civil rights movement. And this includes your oral histories in each case. So did you participate in Freedom Summer in 1964? Or did your parents, and they told you about it? Or anyone you know? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you, Brian. I'm glad to be here. I called in because I was a Yale junior in 1964, and the SNCC leaders had come to Yale and were trying to recruit. I wanted to go, but I had to work because I was a scholarship student. So I wangled myself to get to be like a cub reporter for the Boston Globe, and I went out to that training session in Ohio. And by the way, one of the things they were trained were not to respond. They trained them, if they fell down, then the SNCC people would pretend to kick them and all kinds of things, too, so that they wouldn't fight back and to protect their heads and their vital organs from attack. But it was an exciting, dramatic, fun, scary as hell summer. I went down there with a fellow from Life and a photographer, Steve Shapiro, who I think is still active, and we got to Ruleville, to the home of Fannie Lou Hamer, who was cutting her husband's hair in the shade of a pecan tree. But then we heard that three kids had been missing from Philadelphia. No one had heard of Philadelphia, Mississippi. It was way over by the Alabama border. But we went over there, and they were missing. And the scariest thing, Brian, was that I was there when they found the car, the Mickey Schwerner's car.
Really?
It had been burned out. But what I try to communicate is it was like they poured gasoline and burned it. But it looked like an angel of hell had come and visited that car.
Michael, thank you very much for your memories. I appreciate you calling up. And let's go to another caller, Mary in Newark. Mary, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. And I have a story to tell, but before that, I just wanted to mention about training, that those of us who were in Ohio being trained for freedom schools had a huge reading list. We read W.E. Du Bois and Histories of the South and had an incredible curriculum to study and try to absorb. But the story I wanted to tell was this. I worked in Moss Point in Pascagoula on the Gulf Coast, which was a little different than other areas of the state. And we had a young English woman with us on holiday, and she had been writing letters that were sent from the Midwest to her family in London, saying what a good time she was having in Minnesota. So we were all arrested one day, and we were in jail in Pascagoula, and we were in a cell next to a bunch of white kids, local white kids. And they got on with us until they realized we were what they call COFOs, and then they began filling little cups of cold water and throwing it over the partition. It didn't really amount to that much. But when we got our one phone call to make, when you're in jail, you do get that, and they generally abided by that. Mm-hmm. She called Reuters, the young woman from England on holiday. She called Reuters. She said she was on hunger strike in jail in Mississippi in Pascagoula, and that somehow what came out in the newspaper the next day in London was that the cell was being flooded with cold water, and she was on hunger strike, and she was in jail in Mississippi.
That was smart, course, calling Reuters. I guess you could use your one phone call to call your mother and cry, or you could call Reuters and bring the attention of the world.
And that's what she did. And so her father, who was a sort of well-to-do businessman, called the town of Moss Point, where our project was centered, and talked to the mayor. And he became an honored guest of the town of Moss Point. The mayor had him on radio, where he apologized for his daughter. He stayed for free in the mayor's motel. And he said he would take her back, but she wouldn't go. So that's my one story, but the stories abound, and it was an
indeed
incredible, incredible experience. Changed my life.
Mary, thank you so
much. Lots of wonderful things happened there.
Thank you so much. And listeners, who else was there in Freedom Summer in 1964? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As we acknowledge the 50th anniversary with historian Peniel Joseph and your calls, and we're going to have a special surprise guest joining us, too, in just a couple of minutes. But, Peniel, I want to read part of a letter from one of the White Northern volunteers, Martha Honey, who happens to be the mother of Brian Lehrer Show producer Jody Avergan, and she wrote this letter to a friend of hers the night of Cheney's funeral. We've posted it in full on our website through our connections, and I'm just going to excerpt a few lines here. She wrote, "As a White Northerner, I can get involved whenever I feel like it and run home whenever I get bored or frustrated or scared." And she adds, "I am angry because I have a choice as to whether or not to work in the movement, and I am playing upon that choice and leaving here. And what is making it worse is that all those damn Northerners are thinking of me as a brave hero." Does that give you chills when you hear it? And what do you want to say about the dynamic between the people who actually had to live that discrimination in the South and the relatively privileged white Northerners who were coming down to help temporarily?
Well, that's a beautiful sentiment, and I think she's spot on. I think one of the things that, you know, all the callers have been really brilliant, but Freedom Summer is really a hinge point in history. And one of the things that you do see is that there are these reverberations for blacks and whites. The reverberations for whites include volunteers like Mario Savio, who is a Freedom Summer volunteer and then is going to start the free speech movement in Berkeley that fall. The reverberations for blacks in many cases are going to be much different because we're going to see real disappointment and disillusionment after the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which is coming out of Freedom Summer, is rejected at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City. Fannie Lou Hamer makes her famous speech before the Credentials Committee. And this is right on the heels of the funeral of James Cheney, which is August 7th. And I think the bodies are found August 4th. So there is this notion of white privilege, right? But there also is this notion of racial integration, which is this really beautiful notion, and this notion of interracial activism. And I think one thing we have to say, too, Brian, is that when we think about the Freedom Summer volunteers, there is a huge proportion of those white volunteers who are Jewish Americans as well. So it's a really wonderful high point of black Jewish relations that has really been lost in the subsequent 50 years. But it's really a high point.
Roger in Cortland Manor. You're on WNYC. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. You were there in 1964?
No. I wrote a biography of King and interviewed Bob Moses several times, and I wanted to point out a couple of things. The reason for bringing in, for having Mississippi Summer, was to basically to put white kids in danger, because that was the only way to get the national media and the FBI involved in what was going on in Mississippi, which was extraordinarily lawless and dangerous at that time. That summer, to put it into perspective, there were 6 workers killed, not 3. And there were 35 shot, 80 beaten, 1,000 arrested, 30 buildings bombed, 35 churches burned. The whole state was basically in revolt.
Peniel, you want to talk to Roger, compare historical notes here?
Yeah, no, I think he's exactly right. I think one of the things that we have to remember is right before Freedom Summer, and really what SNCC called the Summer Project, began, the state of Mississippi purchased a number of different weapons and guns. They purchased basically a tank. They warned their residents of an invasion that was coming. They spread fallacious rumors that SNCC had promised white students $10 a week and all the sex they could handle, quote unquote, to come down to Mississippi. So they basically viewed the volunteers as hippies in their minds, who were lawless, who were communists, who were drug addicts, and were trying to besmirch the reputation and the honor of the state. And they sent out rumors that many of the black students were going to try to sexually assault local white women. So it was a very, very dangerous time. And one of the things we have to balance out, though, is that when we think about freedom schools and those things that happen, there's 175 freedom school teachers that would end up teaching over 2,000 students in over 20 different communities that summer. And there's going to be 13 community centers that are set up. And one thing we should add is the Free Southern Theater, which gave musical performances and different cultural and artistic performances all throughout Mississippi that summer, which was connected to SNCC and connected to the civil rights movement as well.
Well, you mentioned how the opposition, the local opposition to these students coming down, that march, Samuel Bowers, who was the imperial wizard of the white knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi, authorized Klan members in Neshoba County to kill some of the workers. They were, and that's the area where Schwerner was working. If you think about Bob Moses, he was brought down there by Amzie Moore, who was head of the Cleveland chapter of the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And Moore, at that point, was one of the few black leaders left in Mississippi, because others like Gus Counts, Bill Zani, and George Lee had been murdered. Lee was murdered in 63. The FBI didn't care, wouldn't do anything about it.
And in fact, let me play a piece of historical audio that we found on a remarkable hour-long NBC News documentary that aired at the time, and we've linked to this. It's on YouTube. We've linked to it on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. This is unbelievable, from Ross Barnett, former governor of Mississippi. He was governor in 1964. Listen to what he has to say.
And it's pitiful that parents haven't trained their children in the way that they should have. They ought to stay at home and work. They ought to stay at home and tend to their own business. We will treat anyone with great respect here in Mississippi. Anyone who comes here, as long as they do not disobey our laws. But we will treat the people who come here, these children, like any other backward children should be treated.
We will treat these children like any other backward children should be treated. And to clarify, he was already a former governor of Mississippi at that time in 1964. But was that a veiled murder threat, Peniel Joseph?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we see there is that even though, yes, the FBI and the attention of the world becomes riveted once Schwerner and Goodman are killed, everybody's lives were still in danger. And there was really the idea of white supremacy in Mississippi was considered tradition. It was considered part of the culture. So certainly those folks were threatened. And I think one of the interesting things when we think about Freedom Summer is the fact that the second congressional district director of the Delta was Stokely Carmichael. And this is Stokely Carmichael before Black Power. There's all these white workers and volunteers under him. There's people like Black SNCC activists like Judy Richardson in Greenwood. Bob Zellner is the director in Greenwood, and Stokely's the second congressional district director. So it's a time of great unity. So you think to yourself, 2 years later, Carmichael's going to be screaming for Black Power, but in 64, he's not. In 64, he's actually working with these interracial groups of folks trying to register people, trying to get small-d democracy in Mississippi. So it's a really interesting time period that we kind of write out of history if we don't think to ourselves. It's a very unified time, even though there's all this tension because of what they're facing.
And Roger, thank you for your call and chiming in with your understanding of history. So let's talk specifically about the murder of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. Cheney was Black from Meridian, Mississippi. Schwerner and Goodman were both from the New York area, Goodman from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And that NBC News documentary also included clips of parents of both missing boys. I guess one body had been found, and that's why the other two were still considered missing. Peniel Joseph, is that right?
I think so.
And so here is Ms. Ben Cheney, mother of James Cheney, talking to a reporter.
How did you feel about his getting involved in a civil rights movement?
Well, when he first, I didn't think nothing about it when he first started. But after he was in Canton for a while and told me, he came home and told me about how it was and everything, then we discussed it, and he told me, he said, well, Mother, that's what I want to do. He said, because this is not for me and not for you. This is for all, for everybody.
What kind of a boy is your son?
He's a nice, marvelous child, and he's brave. Whatever he went for it with all his mind and heart. He wasn't afraid.
Wasn't afraid. And here is Carolyn Goodman, Andrew Goodman's mother.
We both knew he was going into a dangerous situation, and we both knew that there were things that he was going to have to face, and, we just embraced each other as he was about to leave. We both are quite desperate to hear from him. I don't have to tell you that we're heartbroken and want more than anything in the whole world to hear from our son.
Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, to clarify, all three of them were missing at that moment. Those were clips that NBC obtained of two of the parents at that time. And we are joined now for a few minutes by a very special guest, David Goodman, Andrew Goodman's brother, who heads the Andrew Goodman Foundation. David is in Mississippi this week for ceremonies honoring the Freedom Summer. And David Goodman, thanks so much for joining us. Hello from New York.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. And you're right, I've been in Mississippi. I'm actually today in Atlanta, Georgia. 2 seconds ago, I had to step out. I was with Congressman John Lewis, who's dedicating the Center for Civil and Human Rights. It was quite an emotional event because Lisa McNair was there. She's the sister of Denise McNair, who was killed and murdered in the Birmingham church. In 1963, and I was also with the Liuzzo daughters, whose mother came from Chicago and was shot point blank by the Ku Klux Klan, a white woman, for driving around people at the March on Selma to Montgomery, and it was a fantastic gathering. But thank you for inviting me on your show.
What did you think when you heard your mother's voice there from 1964?
Well, you know, it was at a time when they were still missing, and we had no idea that, or at least I didn't. I was 17. My brother was 3 years older, that anyone could murder somebody because they won the vote. Now, I mean, you can say I was naive. I think it was just a matter of unconscious state of mind, and I think most of the white country, if you didn't live in the South, didn't appreciate how dangerous it was for people to stand up against the tremendous resistance and to keep a way of life what we call today racist and un-American, but that's not how the people who were upholding it saw it. So she was missing a son, and it was a personal tragedy, but it was also an American story and an American tragedy.
Your mother recently wrote a book about this, didn't she?
Well, yeah, she passed away in 2007, and for 20 years she was trying to put down her thoughts in terms of her life in the context of the movement, the human dignity, social justice, civil rights movement in our country, of which she was a part of well before my brother was murdered. And she wrote it in conjunction with a fellow by the name of Brad Herzog. Fortunately, it was finished before she passed away.
The book is called My Mantelpiece, correct?
That's correct.
Now, one of the things that people may not remember about the event, if they ever knew it, is that many people claimed it was a hoax or a publicity stunt. In fact, here is a historical clip of President Johnson talking at the time, again, your brother was still missing, with Mississippi Senator James Eastland. This is from the White House archives.
Jim, we've got three kids missing down there. What can I do about it?
Well, I don't know. I don't believe there's three missing. Now, I'm going to tell you why I don't think there's a damn thing to it. They were put in jail in Philadelphia, in East Mississippi, right next to county, right next to John Stennis's home county. And they were going to Meridian. There's not a Ku Klux Klan in that area. There's not a citizens' council in that area. There's no organized white man in that area. So that's why I think it's a publicity stunt.
Did you ever hear that clip before, David?
Yes, I did. It's pretty stunning. However, if you understand the spirit of the times from the point of view of the power structure, they just wanted to sweep this under the rug and see it go away. Eastland knew they were dead.
Knew they were dead?
Absolutely. There's no question in my mind. I mean, you couldn't live in Mississippi and understand that culture without understanding what would happen to a person. I mean, if you disappeared, they're assumed dead. That's what everybody from Mississippi told me who was alive and still alive at the time. And we just didn't understand that people could be that way. I got to tell you, again, I'm saying it may seem naive, but that's the way it was.
And it I guess, is even more galling to hear in that clip that he denied that there was Klan in that area, in the Meridian area, and they were, in fact, killed by Klan members in that area, correct?
That's right. Of course. I mean, they knew. Not only did all the elected politicians know where the Klan was concentrated, but they knew that certain parts of the South were more violent than the others, and it has to do with a long story around who settled the area, and a lot of the people in that part of Mississippi for bootleggers, and they didn't like the government. They didn't see any points for law. They took care of law themselves, and this was just a custom and habit. So it's consistent with decades, maybe centuries, of the social structure there, and when they didn't like somebody, they meaning the Klan and members of the Klan, they take care of themselves in their way. And it's very hard to share that with people who aren't really aware of our history. Our country's fascinating. By the way, this story has been repeated in all parts of our country at one point, one time or another. And this is particularly painful because not only did they murder my brother, they assassinated the Constitution of the United States.
Peniel, Joseph, anything you want to say to David Goodman?
Oh, no, Dave, I think he's definitely doing heroic work, and I'm sorry for your loss. I think that local authorities were also implicated in the murder of Andy Goodman and Mickey Schwerner and James Chaney in terms of Deputy Sheriff Cecil Price and others who at times faced legal charges as well in terms of the implication of the disappearance and the subsequent murder of those three civil rights workers.
And David Goodman, thank you so much for giving us some time today as you acknowledge the loss of your brother in that murder 50 years ago yesterday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's get a couple of more oral history calls on from some of you, remembering your participation in Freedom Summer 1964 with historian Peniel Joseph. Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Deborah.
Oh, thank you very much. I have a very personal memory. I was 9 years old in 1964, and my Texas-born bred parents were living in a state just north of the Mason-Dixon. My mother was a high school librarian, and the topic of the passing of the Civil Rights Act had been active for nearly a year in my little town. You know, the House of Representatives passed it in February 10, and then the Senate on June 10th, and then the President Johnson signed it into law July 2nd. And because my mother's in public and her support of it, we had gangs of men and boys driving past our house soon after July 2nd for several days and weeks, and they would throw rocks and eggs at our house, and it culminated sometime in July. In August, with a tree on our property at night being set aflame, and people were shouting and yelling, and the fire truck came and the police, because you looked and there was a person hanging on the tree, that someone had been lynched and torched on the tree. And so they put out the tree, and blessedly, it was someone who'd been lynched and torched in effigy, a life-size figure. But there was a sign near the tree with a name on it, and it had my mother's name on it. Those men lynched and burned my mother in effigy because of her support of the passage of the Civil Rights Act and speaking out on that. And
my God.
Freedom Summer 64.
How has that affected you through your life?
Well, profoundly, because then 12 years later, at the age of 21, I found myself in the middle of the cotton patch teaching in a little school in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I found myself working 3 days a week in Parchman, teaching adult basic ed and GED to women in the women's camp in Mississippi State Penitentiary. And we would pass Fulville 3 times a week where Ms. Hamer lived, going to and from Parchman from Clarksdale. And that year, Ms. Hamer died. She died March 14th, 1977. She was 59, and she died of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any commotion or notice or anything about her passing locally. It was like some ordinary person had passed on. Mm.
Deborah, thank you so much for your memories. It sounds like a tough day for you. Hang in there. Thank you for sharing it with us. Margot Adler, NPR News correspondent, calling in with a memory. Hey, Margot.
Hi there, Brian.
So where were you in the summer?
I was actually in 65, the year afterwards. I was a friend of the Goodman family and also had been at Berkeley, a free speech movement veteran, and so I saw Mario Sarvi and others get real leadership skills. So I went down to one of the worst places in Mississippi, Belzoni in Humphrey County. And even after that whole first year, there had been no one registered. I think it's very hard to understand the palpable fear that really was everywhere. When you got people to agree to register the next day and you came for them, they suddenly had to see the doctor or they suddenly were not there at all. And it's really hard for people growing up now to realize how much poverty there was. I was living in a house in which there was no running water. There was an outhouse outside with pigs running around. We brushed our teeth by basically, you know, over the fence, essentially with a glass of water. There was no sewage at all. So when it rained, it was incredible. And there were no doctors, no doctors. So when you knocked on people's doors, basically the number of sick people who hadn't seen anyone was just, I mean, it was just amazing. And we were, in a sense, as white students, we were, in a sense, hostages, because without us, just so many people would just get killed and no one would notice. Mm. But if a white student who was like a senator's, you know, daughter or something got killed, someone would notice, you know? And the other thing that I would like to say, the last thing is also that I was, in the last days I was there, I and a group of five of us went in a car, and we got lost on a lonely plantation. And after we had seen these people to talk to them about registering, White Citizens Council started following us on this lonely plantation. And we got lost, and we were suddenly at a dead end, and they came to us. And basically, all the guys, which was everybody but me, they told the one African-American guy to go into the cornfields and disappear. And then the white students, every one of them was beat up, and I was just left in the car. And then the next day, when we went to the police, you know, and tried to, or the FBI, to try to help, you know, this is why Mississippi Birding is such a false movie. Basically, we went to them, and what their response was, that they took the 18-year-old kid that was in our group and marched him down to the draft board.
Wow. Did it take some special courage on your part to go down there in 1965, the year after Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney? You knew what the risks were.
I knew what the risks were, and, you know, I knew the family, and I don't know, but I had been, you know, I had had such an experience in the free speech movement where we had achieved victory that I felt very encouraged by that. And at the end of that summer, only 7 people were registered in Belzoni. But then the voting rights happened, and suddenly everything changed.
Margot, thank you so much for chiming in. Great to hear your voice and an amazing set of memories from NPR's Margot Adler on Freedom Summer 1964. And historian Peniel Joseph from Tufts University and author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. To finish up on her last point, not that many people got registered in what was billed as this voter registration drive for African Americans in Mississippi. I know it started with something crazy low, like 6% of eligible black voters registered, but it didn't end with that many either, did it?
No, it didn't. And when we think about Freedom Summer, it's not going to be all about just voter registration, because until the Voting Rights Act is passed in August of 1965, the protections to force registration aren't there. So what it's really about is civic education through the freedom schools that people like Charlie Cobb and others start. People like Stokely Carmichael, Bob Moses are teaching in. It's a civic education, and it's also voting political power through the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party that's coming out of Freedom Summer. Very quickly, June, July, August are very incredible, because during Freedom Summer and 2 weeks after James Cheney's funeral, the Democratic National Convention convenes in Atlantic City, and hundreds of folks from Freedom Summer are bused to Atlantic City, including Fannie Lou Hamer. And what they do is they're on the boardwalk and inside of the convention. And Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, there's huge placards and posters, and people are marching up and down the Atlantic City boardwalk, and they're trying to be seated. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is trying to unseat the all-white delegation of the state of Mississippi that's not allowing African-American inclusion. And Lyndon Johnson personally makes sure that the MFDP and Mrs. Hamer are not allowed to be seated. They're offered a compromise of 2 non-voting delegates. They reject that compromise. And that's really going to set in motion some of the splits that we're going to see in the movement. Within 2 years, Carmichael is calling for black power in Mississippi. A lot of the root of that is in Atlantic City and during Freedom Summer. And Mrs. Hamer does her famous Credentials Committee testimony, where she says, "Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we're beaten for wanting to live like decent human beings?"
Well, people on our comments page are posting that we need a new Freedom Summer, that voting rights are still under attack. So that's another conversation to keep having. But we will keep having historian Peniel Joseph from time to time through sometime into next year to talk about the 50th anniversaries of these various mileposts in the civil rights movement. Peniel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you who called in with your Freedom Summer oral histories.